What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Kind of Funny Games Cast. I'm one of your hosts, Greg Miller, alongside the Pride of Long Island, Colin Moriarty.
Go Islanders. It's good to be here with you, Greg.
It's good to be here. We finally dropped the dead weight. We listened to the comments. Everybody hates Tim. Gone. That's all it took. Now, Tim's in LA. He'll be back soon. Thank you for putting up with it. I've never hosted a podcast before. I hope this goes well. I don't talk about games often. I don't know. You never know what's going to happen.
I think we'll be okay.
Colin.
Good luck.
Yes.
When we said we need somebody to fill in for Tim, we said we needed somebody as smart as him, who is as accomplished as much as him, who has traveled the world like him, and that's why I picked up Ryan Payton.
Right, right.
Ah, welcome.
Ryan Payton, thank everybody. You are, if for some reason people didn't know you, preposterous. You're a big-time game developer. You work at Camouflage right now.
Trying to be.
You originally put out this game.
That's the
Republic.
Republic.
Now, Republic Remastered just came out on Steam, Mac, Good Old Games, Humble. You can go get it all those places. Did I get them all?
Yeah, we're not on Mac Store yet, but...
I thought you were saying earlier it was going to be on Mac.
No, and I corrected you earlier, but that's
oh,
okay.
Oh, damn it. I just don't listen to you.
Greg doesn't listen.
Once you gave the initial information, I was like, well, that's all
you
I need
really
to know.
You did really good, though. I think you got 3 out of the 4, so...
Yeah, okay, good. That's not too shabby. That's not too shabby.
Real good.
Thank you for coming to join us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course, we're recording this after you were on Colin Reg Live, so if you remember that episode... This means we're still at the eve of launch, Republic
correct.
Remastered.
Yes.
But by the time they hear it, it'll be out.
Exactly. You can go pick it up on all the places I just said, except for the one that doesn't exist yet. But
yeah.
We'll one day.
Right. We'll be on the Mac Store at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Keep teasing.
And we were working on
getting it on this...
Lovely device that Greg and I haven't stopped talking about since it was the NGB.
If you're at home, he's holding up a place, or if you're listening to MP3, he's talking about the PlayStation Vita.
Yeah, we made some exciting moves and hope that today will
hooking you up with the right people.
Man,
over
we'd
there.
Love to have the game on the Vita.
I'm sure.
I think it would be perfect on
Vita.
It would be perfect. It really would be.
You know, because of the touch interface.
Exactly. Yeah. Republic. Give the elevator pitch for everybody who doesn't know.
Yeah, Republic is a game that we've been building for the last 3 years. It's a stealth action game mixed with. A lot of hacking elements. It's a game about paranoia, government surveillance, privacy. It follows a protagonist named Hope who calls you on her stolen phone and asks you to help her escape from a secret totalitarian nation. So
not too shabby. Colin, that setup was a lot like you.
Yeah.
Worried about this, worried about that.
Always worried about something.
The government.
So are you like main man, just paranoid and being careful what you say online?
Yeah, well, I think...
Text and...
Yeah, I'm not so careful about what I say as much as I know they're listening. And every once in a while, like when my dad and I are always complaining about politics when I talk to them on the phone when I call back to Long Island, and every once in a while I'll say something and then I'll just be like, you know, and I know the NSA is listening, so fuck you guys if you're listening to this right now.
Dirty bomb.
Just give all the
keywords.
The keywords.
I think a lot of people do that, you know. There's a study that we might reference in episode 4, episode 5 that journalists have there's a survey that they actually change the way that they write or they think about they're more careful about the way that they're writing whether it's emails or articles because they know that they're being listened to or could be listened to or could be showing up as like different like hot you know like these kind of keywords that could show up in some of this data that they're collecting. So it's not good. It's not a healthy thing.
We'll be fine. Dude, it's not like
you sound like my dad. He's like, I got nothing to hide.
Yeah, that's the problem. That mentality is a big issue.
Basically, what you're saying is I don't care about my rights.
Pretty much.
No. Well.
Give me video games. I don't care at all about my rights.
Greg opens every phone conversation with his mom by saying the following words. His mom will be like, hello, and he'll be like, terrorist, Abu Ghraib, cocaine,
Freedom Tower.
Ukraine, Freedom Tower. 9/11.
Anyways, Mom, I was just calling to see if I had the right.
Did you know that you have their attention?
Nick Scarpino's, Nick Scarpino's here. He's moving the light.
Hey,
Nick, how you doing?
Good.
You know, we don't put him on one Kind of Funny Games Cast. He breaks in, swings the light all around,
looking
changes
good.
It around.
Looking good, man.
You happy now, Pappy? We love Nick Scarpino so much. If you didn't know, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Kind of Funny Games Cast. The idea is simple. Each and every week, we come to you, three best friends around this table, each bringing not a topic. I've never introed this one. This
no,
is why
no, you're introing exactly like Arthur's show, which is
that's why Tim
not
just does the rigmarole and then stops.
Mm-hmm.
Kind
go
of
to kindoffunny.com and you'll find
exactly.
All the information.
Support us on Patreon. Thank you so much. Every week we bring this show to you about video games on Friday. You can get it on Patreon early, and if not, it's broken out topic by topic, day by day on YouTube until we post the entire thing for free. On YouTube and MP3 services around the globe. So now here's the thing. We talk about topics.
Talk to me
show.
About it.
Ryan Payton. You gave a brief tease of this on Colin Greg Live, but you have to bring it up and tell everybody your official story. The topic number one is Hideo fucking Kojima. You know that I'm a huge Metal Gear fan.
I do.
I love Kojima-san. I love Peace Walker. It's the best game of last generation. My favorite game of all time. It's time to get into the fact that not only are you a Metal Gear fan, You worked on Metal Gear 4. You worked with this man in Japan. You were his right hand. You were like his ninja. He sent you out on missions.
Cyborg ninja.
Yeah, exactly. You were his Gray Fox. You were his Meryl. I want to know everything about Hideo Kojima.
What do you want to know, man?
Start for everybody, to bring everybody who didn't catch Colin or Greg live. Let's start with how you got to work with him, how you started in this industry, how you became a game developer.
So you guys can tell me if I'm going a little bit too long, but okay. I'll tell a little bit more.
Please,
about,
this
little,
show is literally, every show we do is a walk. Don't worry.
All right, fair enough, because it depends on how detailed you want to get. But the story is interesting, and I'm not tired of it yet. So
all it did was change your life.
Yeah, it did. It really did. So graduated from college with a degree in foreign languages and business, and I joined this thing called the JET program. Are you one of you gentlemen familiar with it?
No,
I don't know the JET program.
The JET program is an official sponsored Japanese government program to bring native English speaking college graduates to Japan to help teach their junior high and high school students in public school. And so if you're a Japanese kid growing up, you most of the time you would have some gal from Australia or America, England, there to be like a native speaker to help you with your speaking.
Sure. Right?
So I was one of those guys. I was at a high school in rural Japan, didn't know what I was doing there. They sent me there because I could speak Japanese. And so I was just kind of honestly miserable. I thought I was going to, you know, because you have that vision of, you know, growing up of Japan, like it's like Blade Runner and I'm going to be eating like ramen and, you know, playing video games all the time and everybody's going to be, I'm going to be talking to robots and it's going to be amazing.
So you're envisioning Akihabara.
Yeah,
you're just living
that's
in Akihabara.
Kinda, that's kind of where I expected I was going to be living. And then they were driving me out to where I was going to be living, which was in this prefecture called Hyogo, which doesn't have a lot of people. And it was like it was 8 hours from anywhere, basically. I know it's a small country, but it's very densely packed, right? And so I was out there in the country, not really knowing what I was doing. Cried my first night, but thankfully I had this freelance gig with Ziff Davis. So I was
never
writing
heard
for Xbox Nation magazine, 1UP.com, EGM. Ended up writing for Wired and Japan Times. So I was able to kind of subsist or kind of regain my sanity by teaching English, which I wasn't really a big fan of, but to writing about video games and covering the Xbox Japan beat.
Ooh.
This is the sexiest beat.
It was popping
off,
man.
This is the best one. I fought really hard for that one. So, I was just... I was traveling over the on the weekends to Tokyo. The guys I was working with had never been to Tokyo, and I was going there every weekend. Because I just couldn't stay in this like, you know, backwater town. It was nice people, but it just wasn't for me. So anyway, I was covering the beat. I was a freelance writer, and
so
I decided.
Rick, were you
to,
living
yes.
in like Inaba? Was this like was this,
this
Persona
was
4?
This
is Persona
Inaka,
4.
Yes.
This is Persona
no,
4.
No, it was way more Inaka countryside
really?
Than the Persona 4 town.
Oh wow.
It's primarily a fishing village, yeah. And this is very common in Japan for any kind of most of like the suburbs or outside of the big cities is that when the kids grow up and they graduate, they go to the big cities and they never come back. So it's mostly old people.
Gotcha.
And the high school was kind of like a Persona high school in the fact that it was more or less haunted because it's a huge high school that they built in like the 60s or the 50s. And there's nobody having kids outside,
yeah.
You know, and so or outside the big cities. So there's like 200 kids for this school that can house 2,000.
Jeez.
And it's just really scary and That's haunting weird. And nobody's my age. And it was weird. It was a weird place to spend 2 years of my life. But I did, again, kind of like was able to kind of connect with the thing I really love by writing about video games. And flew on my own dime to E3 2005 to cover E3 and try to get some money just doing some freelance articles. And I was covering the DS beat. So I was, I think I was looking at like Beautiful Joe DS and Okami DS, maybe. I can't remember some of the games. But I got a call from my editor, James Milkey, who said in a panic that he had overslept or he double booked or something, but he couldn't make his appointment to visit or to meet and interview Hideo Kojima for Metal Gear Solid 3 Subsistence. And as a huge fan, I just played Metal Gear Solid 3. I realized when I played it a month or two before that was my favorite video game of all time.
Wow.
And you can imagine my excitement to be able to run over there and
sure.
interview this guy. So it was me and Scooter and a couple other journalists at the interviewing Hideo. And he noticed that I think in the interview that I understood his answers before it was being translated by his amazing translator, Aki Saito. And after the interview, I was talking to the translator in Japanese. Hideo went to the restroom. When he came back, he overheard us speaking in Japanese, and I had a southern dialect because I was living in the South.
Sure.
And he's like, "Why do you speak in a southern Japanese dialect? This is so weird." And he's like, and then it kind of cut to the chase, like, "Hey, are you interested in interviewing?" I have an open position for a bilingual, you know, guy. Do you want to come in and interview at our offices in Tokyo? And I said, sure, of course.
All right, so here's the timeout I want right now. When you're interviewing him at E3, did you think about speaking to him in Japanese?
I did not. And the reason is because you guys have seen this. You guys are in the press. There are guys who are in the press to be in the press, and there are other guys like turncoats like me who are in the press because I want to be a video game developer. And a lot of these guys will, and I didn't want to be that guy, to interview them for an article, and then afterwards, like, hey, if you ever need somebody for your company,
gotcha.
I just think that's not right.
See, every time I've ever spoken to him, because he's such a hero to me, right, I always think about, man, like, if only I would have listened to Dan Shu and gotten a minor in Japanese when I was going into college. Because how baller would it be to just sit down and do an E3 like couch demo or whatever, and we just have this Japanese conversation. I'm translating for myself, I'm telling what's happening, I'm explaining.
That's
God,
as baller as
awesome,
it gets. That's
right?
As baller as it gets.
Yeah. Well, I frankly think it shows a level of modesty for you to, you know, you're fluent in Japanese, and you know, regardless of your want to get a job or whatever, I don't necessarily think he would have read into that if you just spoke to him in Japanese. Mm-hmm. And I think it shows actually quite a modesty.
Sure, in a group interview especially, it would have cut out like all these other American.
Yeah, and there's something what I thought you were going to say, which was interesting, uh-huh, and maybe it was in your mind or not, was, you know, I only went to Japan, mm-hmm, a couple times, but have dealt with a lot of Japanese developers, right, especially because, sure, you're on the PlayStation beat, is it's a culture of honor and respect. And I would, if I spoke Japanese and I know that this guy came from Japan simply to translate, I would have actually felt bad.
That's true, too. That's a good point.
That's what I thought you might have.
You don't want to be that guy. And those guys do exist. You guys have probably seen them. And they there's like a classic one, like this Nintendojo guy from early 2000s, early 90s, like during like a Nintendo presser at E3, you know, in front of all these, like, it was a time when at the Nintendo presser they would take Q&A at the end. This is way back in the day. And this guy was like, Miyamoto-sama, you know, blah, 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 in Japanese in front of everybody. And they're like, okay, either you're showing off, you're trying to be cool, but none of this works. And I didn't want to be that guy.
Sure.
So, but yeah, it really all worked out. So where were we?
So he had just asked you to come to Tokyo to interview.
He did, right. Gotcha. So obviously I'm super excited. And I on my own dime, go up there multiple times. It's about a $300-$400 round trip from where I was living to do these interviews. And
are you flying? Is that how you're getting
in? I'm flying, and sometimes I'm taking the bullet train. Okay. But it's a day-long trek for me. And at the time, I had quit my English teaching job. I was studying more Japanese in Osaka at the time and running out of money. And interviewed, and I got the word, and it was, you didn't make it. We're interviewing about 25 people, and you didn't make the cut.
Damn.
So that sucked. So I packed my bags. I was like, I'm done. I don't want to live in Japan anymore. And I moved back to Washington State with my folks. Went to Costco, bought World of Warcraft box set, and a 24-pack of Mountain Dew.
Yeah, you did. Fuck yeah, Ryan Payton, you're
like
an OG.
And I decided, I'm done. You know, like, I'm just going to...
I'm hanging up the dreams.
Yeah, this is it. I'm never going to get in the game industry. Because it was too much, like... I was thinking about a similar kind of situation earlier about trying to find the right analogy for it, but I really can't. It's just basically, you never think about it, but then when it's presented to you and you're like, yeah, I want that, and then it's taken away from you.
Sure.
It's that, to be crestfallen like that was really tough. So fast forward about a week or two, I'm playing World of Warcraft, just deciding this is gonna be my life, and living with my parents like a baller.
Yeah.
And I get an email from Konami. Turns out you actually did pass. You actually are the selected chosen one. We got it wrong. Can you start in a month? Because TGS is coming up.
Yeah.
So my immediate response is, oh, this is great. This is great news. You can pay for my trip back, yeah, right? And my move, right. They're like, hell no.
Yeah.
So I had just bought a car.
God.
So sold the car, used the money to pay for the flight, moved all my stuff back to Japan.
Threw away WoW.
Like, never went back.
Nice.
And never had time. And got started just before TGS 2005. Which, when I got in the office the first day, they had ushered me into the editing room, and Hideo wanted me to know. He wanted to ask me like what I thought of the trailer, which you guys will probably remember. It was the first gameplay trailer, first like visual trailer of MGS4, when, you know, Snake is behind that wall, and you can see like the gecko and the soldiers behind him kind of going, and you saw the new Otacon MK2 robot and stuff like that. So, and I thought it looked stunning. So I was like, this is amazing, and I can't believe I'm here. Like, that was really the early days, like the very beginning of that project. So
let me ask you a quick question before we move on with more of the stories. This is actually very fascinating.
This is awesome. You are awesome, Ryan.
Yeah. This is a very, very fascinating story. One thing I want to know is, so Konami made this mistake, or Kojima made a mistake, or as people made a mistake where they selected you and then they didn't tell you. Do you know the story behind that? Was it that they messed up clerically, or did they change their mind?
This bumbling moron shows up, and they're like, "Oh, this is not the guy we wanted."
Did you ever hear anything about that?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I, I'm, I should know. I don't know if I ever asked or if I forgot. But I don't think there was 25 people. There really aren't 25 people that are qualified to do the thing that, you know, they set me up to do. So, yeah. But I know some friends that did interview and didn't get the gig. And I don't know what it was. I mean, I remember being interviewed by Hideo, and he was asking me about my favorite movies and books. And it was true. I was talking about Blade Runner and stuff that he obviously likes Blade Runner. If you look at Snatcher. And there was some stuff that resonated there. But I think there was some concerns about my Japanese. It wasn't awesome. I mean, I major in Japanese. I was writing a lot in Japanese. I was writing for a Famitsu magazine, but it wasn't perfect.
Sure.
So I think that they might have been looking for that perfect candidate who more or less doesn't exist, which is perfect English, perfect Japanese, can do business, marketing, all that kind of stuff. Like, those people are really, really hard to find. And I think they just decided to maybe just train me up to the level that I needed to be, which, you know, I think it ended up working out okay. Well, so then I left 3 years later, so maybe
It bit him in the ass big time. But no. So what is the role they're bringing you on for?
So what they brought me on for in Japanese was called Kaigai Tanto, which Kaigai Tanto means, you guys are very familiar with. Kaigai is like is foreign or outside or international, and then Tanto is kind of like in charge of or manager. So it was kind of in English. I gave myself the title international manager, and then they're like, no, you're not a manager. You're not managing anything. So I was like international coordinator, which basically meant that every day I was emailing back and forth between Konami America, Konami Europe, and then Kojima Productions, coordinating about, hey, you know, E3's coming up or TGS is coming up. Here's the press that's going to be showing up. Here's the box art. Do you guys like the box art? I get the box art from Europe and America. I take it and put it in front of Hideo. So it's kind of like a, you know, messenger, you know, back and forth. Just trying to like coordinate with the different branches.
So what was that like then? Like to be in there, especially with Metal Gear 4, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like you want to talk about pressure. Like this is the one that was going to tie up all the loose ends and do all these different things.
True, but when I joined, it was very early. So it was all about Metal Gear Acid 2. It was all about, there's one other game we were promoting really heavily. Well, there's the digital graphic novel, and there's one more game. Oh, it was Metal Gear Solid 3 Subsistence.
Oh, okay.
I had interviewed Hideo for that on the press side, but then I had to help ship it.
Yeah.
So that was pretty exciting. So when I joined, it was most of the team was actually not on MGS4. They were on Subsistence because, if you guys remember, they added the 3D camera, and there was a lot of work to be done because players could now move the camera anywhere, and they had a bunch of fake stuff where they didn't build out the jungle in areas because they knew that you couldn't see them previous.
Yeah.
Now, because you have the 3D camera, they had to actually build out the jungle more. So that was really interesting to watch that happen. But yeah, I was really just on the PR marketing side, working with Mark Franklin and those guys.
Nice. And so then they start... so many questions.
So I know your question, which is, how did you get from, you know, Paperboy to... actually working on the game.
Yeah, because your title on 4 was producer, right? Yes. Isn't that it?
Yeah. So the big turning point for me was, you know, about a year in, we had shipped Acid 2, and Acid 2 did not sell very well. But the original Acid did sell really, really well, and it was because of what Hideo would call the launch magic. It was a launch title for the PSP, as you guys remember.
Yeah.
And I think there were some kind of false positives related to that franchise. So when Acid 2 didn't sell very well, everybody was basically saying, hey, look, we mistakenly bought Acid 1 because we thought it was a real Metal Gear game. And now we know that the Acid series is not what we want. We want a real Metal Gear game for PSP. And then enter Metal Gear Solid Portable Ops, which we ended up calling it.
Right.
Which I have a really good story about it. And I'm on that cusp of being able to say things without getting in trouble because it's been a while.
You're not allowed to say you have a really good story about it and not tell the story.
Well, I don't want him to get in trouble. Yeah.
Me and Kojima are friends. It's cool. He follows me on Twitter. I gave him that painting at E3. Don't get yourself.
I won't go into details, but let's just say that just the name of it was a lot of work to get that through because if you might have noticed, you might not have noticed, but that in America and in Europe, that no PSP game had the title Portable in it.
Interesting.
And it was for some reasons, and not like any kind of conspiratorial reasons or whatever, but it was just kind of a Sony thing. And we had to go really, really high up to get that title because we wanted Metal Gear Solid Portable Ops. Why? Because we wanted the acronym to be like an NPO. This is very Metal Gear kind of thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
So we went for MPO, and we had to, and Hideo asked me to come up with a bunch of acronyms that could work for an MPO, a Metal Gear PO. What could that be? And the best thing we could come up with was Portable Ops. And because it had the name Portable in there, Sony didn't really like that.
Sure.
So we had to go get some permissions.
That's weird.
It's kind of a weird inside baseball story.
And I'm trying to think of like PSP games with Portable, and you're right, I can't. Actually,
yeah, that's a really good point.
Now in Japan they do like Monster Hunter Second Portable, things like that, but in the States they were trying to avoid that for whatever reason. So
these portables were so poo-pooed.
Yeah,
this handheld game, this isn't a real game.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that was the thinking. I'm not quite sure. So So
just like when we used to have to like, well, this is pretty good for a digital game.
Yeah.
Like those days.
Oh,
those
yeah.
days. Remember
oh,
that?
Yeah, I remember
oh,
that.
Oh, man. Shadow Complex
days,
is really
those
good
days
for
still
an arcade
but for a
game.
Download game.
Unfortunately, yeah.
that's
I know, still
I know. Indie station. Yeah, that's whatever. Different. Now you can be a download as long as you are backed by a giant corporation. Yeah. Everybody's happy with it. It's when it gets out there. So anyway, sorry.
Or be Minecraft.
Or be Minecraft. We're still on the road to you becoming producer.
We're still on the road to me becoming producer. So Portable Ops was my big break. And the reason being is that now the team is the full team. 90% of the team is on Metal Gear Solid 4. It's a huge game, as you guys know. But the Acid team has now evolved into the Portable Ops team. And they don't have a ton of support. And the game needs to be shipped within a year. They had a year to make
really?
That game. And that game's really good.
Yeah, I loved it.
And the producer on that was really awesome. Like the executive producer name is Okamura-san. And he was asking me for a lot of help, basically. He was like, hey, beyond what I was normally used to doing. And so I would fly to Australia to meet with Ashley Wood, who did all the cinematic art, like the thing on your wall, right? Behind you. Like Ashley Wood, you know, did that. And so I was helping a lot more with my production. And what ended up happening was, again, without getting into too much detail to get me in trouble, but the director was having some trouble, and he was working tons of hours, and he just couldn't get full coverage onto the game. And so myself and the audio director, his name is Akihito Honda, he and I were young, crazy. I had moved right next to the studio in Roppongi.
Nice.
That's really expensive, really stupid, but I just wanted to be at work all the time. I was living my dream. And we would, after my real job was done about 10 p.m., Honda and I would just play the latest build of Portable Ops every night. We'd play till about 2 or 3 in the morning. And you guys know it's a really good, addicting game.
Yeah.
But lots of problems we saw, and we just wrote up reports. And I would write them up every morning, or actually before I went to bed. And so when the development team came in the next morning, they had a bunch of feedback. And I just and they saw like, oh, this boss battle's broken, this boss battle's cheap, or this place looks this area of the map looks really bad or whatever. And I wasn't, it was just like to help out. It wasn't like my game or whatever. And Okamura came to me about for a week after I kept doing this, and he's like, keep it going. Just keep doing that. I'm like, all right. So for about 3 or 4 months I just kept doing it, playing it every night. And basically kind of doing what a real game director should do, but we always get too busy to do that. I don't do this on Republic and I should.
Yeah.
We get close to ship. It's supposed to come out before Thanksgiving because that's the sales period, the retail sales period, and the game's just not ready. So I get permission to fly to America and beg for forgiveness and ask them to delay Portable Ops by a month into December. And they say, like, nobody ships in December. I'm like, that's my secret. It's like, that's now it is. Like, I love shipping in December because you get, we've done it with Republic, we might do it again with Episode 5. We'll see. But it's you get like a lot of press coverage there because there's all the games have
it's
already
quiet.
Come out. It's quiet. And they let us do it. And the game was a huge hit. I think it might even got a 10 from IGN, Portable Ops.
No way.
I might be wrong about this.
I think you're wrong.
I might be wrong about this, but the game reviewed really, really well and sold really well.
I remember that me and it was Jeff and I that were there, and we were playing it on PSP. We loved it.
And I don't want to take credit for it because I came in, you know, last 3 or 4 months of it, but we laid the foundation for what ended up becoming Peace Walker. You know, a lot of that Pokemon stuff, a lot of that Jagged Alliance stuff.
That was the whole thing of these bite-sized missions to go out and play, come back.
Yeah, recruit those soldiers, use Wi-Fi. All that stuff came from that Portable Ops team.
Oh, and I'm way wrong. I wasn't even working at IGN when this came out. 9.0.
9.0.
Yeah, I must be. They did a second one, didn't they? Or like, there was like a...
And MGS4 got a 10.
They did a Portable Ops Plus, which is not good. That was really bad. So Colin, what was your question?
I was just gonna say MGS4 got a 10, so you might be.
Oh, maybe I was thinking about that, but yeah, 9 out of 10. Yeah,
nine's still amazing. Yeah,
really good. So it was like a Christmas party or something, launch party, and Hideo came over to me. I was just kind of sitting by myself, and he's like, "You did really good. You did really good on that on Portable Ops." I heard from the team. I was like, "Oh, thanks, man." And he's like, "I want you to do that on MGS4." Okay. So Monday morning, the next week, in front of 200 people, he's like, "Ryan, I want you to come in front of the group." I'm like, "Okay." Me, 26 years old or whatever, and he's like, "We're promoting Ryan. He's going to be in charge of playing the game and giving feedback, and he's gonna help us sell this game in the States, basically, and he's gonna help us fix our controls, make sure the boss battles are tuned properly, help out with the script and all that kind of stuff." And man, it was
this is all news to you at the moment.
Oh yeah, this is a dream.
Your eyes are just getting as big as saucers, I imagine.
Yeah. I was like, okay, well, I'll do it.
Was there any, at any point did you pull him aside and be like, I don't know about this, man. I'm just
no, man. Kidding. I knew I could do it. I knew I could do it. Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah. And I wonder if when he was talking about specifically tuning the boss battles and stuff, if you and you know kind of tweaking the story, if originally you were like, how can we get Fat Man back into this?
Yeah, you got to get
that
Fat
was
Man
my
back
first
in there.
Thought.
Yeah,
right. I think actually, I think I might have said that in front of the team. Right. I was like, my first move as a new producer on this title is we're bringing back Fat Man.
I understand. And we like heard, this Fatales idea, yeah, yeah. But no.
And you heard just one person in the United States scream yes, and that was me. Yeah.
You somehow know? You had a telekinetic link.
You go over there, go model those rollerblades. You over there, go model that glass of wine.
I was going to say, I need drink. I need drinks with a little
And we
thing.
Also need the straw. Who's going to do the straw?
Yeah, get all up in that.
Wow,
get all
in that. It's really an amazing story.
Yeah, no, totally.
So I guess what you wanted to get into, Greg, you know, because we
No,
both,
this
we,
is great. This is exactly, this is fine. This
but,
is
I'm, but I'm curious because I think we can really get into some meat here now. Yeah. Because we're both Metal Gear fans, but I kind of fell off with the series after Metal Gear Solid 2, and you are still a huge Metal Gear fan.
Yeah.
And obviously Kojima has this aura and mystique in the West and has forever. Right. Like everyone, like
first off,
I remember the first time we met him together. I was like,
in the
it was like,
line.
Yeah, it was like one of the first times I meet famous people all the time. Inafune is my favorite developer, and I was there's only him and like only a select others where I was like, oh my god, like I'm meeting like
an
royal
hero.
Basically.
Yeah.
And so I was just curious, like, so what is the man like? I mean, that's you know that's what I kind of
I mean, there's so many questions about him. Like, is he a vampire? Why doesn't he age? Why does this man not age? It's insane.
Well, him and Fumito Ueda must be going to the same clinic. You know? That guy doesn't age either. Yeah, it's just this Japanese thing, man. You guys see it all the time. Like, you know, Japanese movie stars. All their life expectancy is a lot longer than we have here in the States. And stuff like that. So it's diet, you know, in Japan, and he tweets. He makes sure that you know what he's eating every day, right? So. They eat really healthy, and you know he started to really exercise during MGS4. He got really really fit and got really muscular.
Yeah.
If you look at pictures of him MGS3 era versus MGS4 era, you can see he got really ripped.
Yeah.
So
it's got to get out there.
And he's putting a lot of pressure on me and Ken, who was Imaizumi, who was my boss, and was really supportive during that whole time. And he was like, "You guys got to go to the gym and do this stuff." And I was like, "Dude, I'm working on the game, man. Got to make this game good."
So is he like? At what point you're a fan too, you know, you were blown away to go interview him. At what point does that start to wear off and does he ever just become your boss, one of the guys kind of thing? Or
I honestly remember in 2005 when I joined talking to friends about how as much as a fan I am of Metal Gear Solid 3, I wasn't necessarily, and I don't want this to come across the wrong way, but I wasn't necessarily a Hideo Kojima fan.
Okay.
And I think that was really important joining the company. And I don't think he wanted that, right? Maybe he saw that in me. I don't really know. But I was just as much I was there for him and appreciated the opportunity, and he really did help me, and especially in those early years getting involved in, you know, the company and everything. But I was there for him. I was there for the franchise. I was there for the fans. And I was there for the team. And I really started to learn over time if there was one big takeaway. And I remember interviewing with Microsoft talking about this, is that it wasn't like I was fighting for him. I was actually fighting for the other 100, like 199 guys who are working on the game, who are killing themselves, who don't get the same recognition that he gets. And I just some of my best friends are still the guys at Konami. And I every time I go back to Japan, I just hang out with those guys because you look at the game, they're just so talented, right?
Yeah.
And again, I don't want to take anything away from him, but that group he's got is unbelievable.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I was going to ask, because I mean, that's a really great question in the sense, or just a statement in the sense that there are certain visionaries that you think that we know something about game development, obviously, where it's like you don't think Miyamoto makes the game by himself. You don't think Inafune made the game Mega Man by himself. You don't think, you know.
Yeah.
But what is that dynamic like when you have a outward visionary style person leading a project where you know that no one, I don't want to say no one, but 90% of your audience really doesn't give a fuck about anyone but Kojima, you know, and thinks that every decision is his and he wrote the whole story and he designed every character and did all these things. Like, what is it like working in a studio? Like, what's the morale like? Because it seems like in Japan it might be a little more of a, again, like an honor-based thing where it's like that's not a problem for them, as opposed to the United States. You actually see less of that here because I think that might be a problem.
Sure.
You know? Like a Cliffy B style person who's like,
right,
Gears of War is Cliffy B, but there's 200 people that worked on that game. Yeah. You know? So like, what is that like?
No, I think
like,
that's a really good question. That's something that I was really conscious of while I was there. And I tried to make, to the best of my effort, when I was doing more PR promotion types of things, with, for example, the making of video of Metal Gear Solid 4, almost killed me. It was so hard, and it was like this 2-hour Blu-ray, and I have a crazy story around that we probably don't have time for, but trying to get
all the time in the world.
I don't know, I don't, I gotta be out of, you know my cutoff time. But the yeah, I tried my best to try to get the team on camera and talking about what they did. And these guys have been working there for 20 years, you know, that yeah. a lot of people aren't familiar with. The same thing, like you were talking about Miyamoto, like the same thing goes for Nintendo. Like they're starting to do that with Iwata ass, like bringing some of the old guard on there. But yeah, there's just so many people behind the scenes. And again, to answer your other question about like, is there like resentment for that within Konami? I don't think there is. I think they're just used to that. And I think they're okay with that. A lot of these guys, I don't think are there for the promotion.
Sure.
And if they are, they're in it for the wrong reasons, quite frankly. Yeah, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, in terms of like the aura around him, like I just never really had that. Like,
right.
I had a lot of respect for him, and he has amazing ideas, and I just have so much respect for like the stories that he's created over the years. And MGS1 was a seminal game for me. That was
right.
the game that made me want to join the game industry more than anything else. And so it was fun working with him, but I just approached him like another guy.
Nice.
Really, that was really important for me.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, it's one of those that, you know, you think about these legends in the game industry, and I always think of Jack Tretton. And I know when he was at Sony PlayStation, he wasn't hanging out with people in the cafeteria chilling out. He has an office.
Right?
He's off over there. He said hi in the elevator, I think, once in a while.
There you go.
That's about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then, what, Metal Gear Solid 4, how long are you, what you get to this producer role, how long are you actually, what's your timetable on that? Like, how much time do you have in that
role? I guess
role?
I have about, this. I must have about a year and a half.
Okay, okay.
So coordinating, I was doing my producer stuff still.
Oh, wow, really?
And then doing the game stuff and also game production, not only just design, but the production. So coordinating trips to Morocco. You know, coordinating trips to Peru for all these different like research trips and to Prague, and so getting involved in that was really fun, but tons of work. And and as you know, I'm having bad flashbacks now about all the game conventions that we did.
Oh yeah,
because you know, Metal Gear is always there. There's always a new trailer, and it never feels like you're making a real game. And I start to see the benefits of it though. It's that the team. One of the things I learned and. About the production of Metal Gear. I don't recommend this, by the way. It's a very expensive, costly way of doing this. But the game, I think the team more or less learned what the game was. Like, the vision of the game came from the trailers.
Really?
So that, you know, it's like a vertical slice of a vertical slice in a sense. Like, oh, now I see where things are going. There's no, like, documentation being thrown around. There's no huge presentations that are like, okay, guys, this is the vision. Here's the five pillars of the game. There's none of that crap. It's more like they're all involved in, like, the production. They're making their small part of the trailer. Then they see the whole thing together along with the rest of the world, they're like, okay, that's what I'm building.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah.
a really interesting approach, and they really push things forward in that kind of these kind of piecemeal little releases, and then they have to buckle down. I think they have to realize, and this has happened to me having worked on a number of different projects there at Konami, is that at some point it comes down to, okay, we have to make a video game now. It's
yeah.
not just trailers. It's not just cinematics.
It's funny. I mean, that made me laugh in the sense that when you feel like you're working on a Metal Gear game and you never think it's real, or like you're not making
yeah.
a game. And it is true in the sense that, like, just like being on the outside, like when the Phantom Pain was revealed, everyone was so excited, and I was like,
what the hell is it?
Well, not even that. I was just like, I don't know. Like,
is this game even a real?
First of all, it's just like, so it's so weird where it's like, I don't know. I'll be excited about when it's here on my PlayStation. But
yeah.
Until like, then, because you just don't know how long it's going to take and what the hell is going to happen. And
right. And you can rightfully assume that they haven't figured out all that stuff too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That Phantom Pain trailer, by the way, is I think the best Metal Gear trailer of all time. I would argue.
Initial reveal.
Yeah, the initial one.
The reveal was cool, and I think it was the same. Was it the same? This I think gives us some insight, because I think it was the same year that The Last of Us was revealed.
Yeah,
right.
VGA.
And then The Last of Us had come out, or like yeah. 2 years ago, and Metal Gear obviously will come out this year. But it's what was so funny to me about that. What I'll never forget about that particular trailer is that it took literally 5 minutes. For someone to be like, it's Metal Gear Solid 5, and the logo fits.
Yeah, put the V in there.
And I was like,
yeah.
And I remember seeing that on GAF for the first time and being like,
no way.
There's no way. Like, that's brilliant, but there's
yeah,
no
yeah.
way that you figured that out. And that's a real thing. And I'm like, no, that really is.
Well, then you go on GAF and you see that there's pictures of Hideo wearing a Moby Dick studio t-shirt.
Yeah.
And you're like, why would he have that? Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It just got really silly really quickly.
I mean, he's a funny dude in that respect, I think, like, where it's just like...
He plays with
yeah,
it. He understands
he's
what
he's basically screwing
is.
With everyone. And
yeah,
I think
yeah.
that's, like, not in a mean way, but it's just like... You have to always look at him and study him and be like, what is it about you that is telling me something about the project? Or,
right.
I think
it's
fun.
He has
a lot of fun with that. And, like,
yeah.
the other...
It's cool.
The way that he promotes is really interesting, right? Really guerrilla style, right?
Yeah. Why doesn't he speak English? I know he understands English. He laughs at my jokes when I'm interviewing him before they get translated the same way you. And I'm like, just talk to me. Let me in.
Just like a lot of Japanese guys, he probably has a lot more confidence in his listening ability.
Mm, okay. That's fine, I guess.
Yeah.
I just want to talk to you today.
Well, you got Babelfish, man.
Yeah. We'll sit there and go back and forth through that. So then you stay through the ship before? When do you leave? That's what I'm not familiar with this part of your career in terms of projects.
So I left a couple months after MGS4 was released.
And was it just time for a new challenge to get back to America? What was it?
A little bit. There was a couple of things. One was so the game shipped on June 12th, 2008, and I was the team had shipped. I want to say that we started around end of April, early May, and the team was going on a long break. And the way that Konami does it's overtime pay or whatever. So they don't pay. They just give you more time off in exchange for the amount of time that you did overtime. And I had accrued about 4 months of vacation. So
you were working just a bit on this game.
Yeah, I was. But my vacation didn't start until after ship because, everybody started and everybody was fine. But then we had this making of video. So I was spending all this time in Vancouver, Canada, and working on this big project with Victor Lucas and those guys up there.
Oh, yeah? EP.
Yeah, and EP Daily. And those guys did a fantastic job on that. Really, really, really good making of video. However, this is one of the stories I didn't want to tell because of time. But I'll give a sneak preview. Is that my goal with that was that I was going to archive with Victor. He wanted to do this too. We were going to archive all the old videotapes that I had found like in the basement of Kojima Productions,
Oh my God.
Of the past 20 years.
Wow.
We were going to capture the entire thing, put it all to XDK. Or not XDK. It was to XD Cam. And yeah, we're going to make the most comprehensive making of documented Metal Gear you've ever seen. And I think we really did pull it off. But I had all these tapes. I only had these are just the originals. I didn't even have time to copy them. I didn't even know how to copy a lot of these different formats. We had everything. We had every kind of video format you can possibly imagine. And so I put them all in this big box and I take it with me to Vancouver, Canada, because we're going to go capture all these things. And I'm jet lagged and I'm at YVR, Vancouver International Airport, waiting for my bags in this box of all these tapes. And I start seeing the tapes.
Oh my God.
I start seeing the tapes.
Oh my God.
But it's not in the box. On this carousel.
Oh no.
Hundreds of tapes just coming off of that little, that machine, right?
Yeah,
the conveyor belt. And then I see the box completely ripped open.
Oh Jesus. I'm
like, and I start seeing tapes fall down in between the cracks between, like, you know, the different
conveyor
belts.
Where the metal things are.
I'm like, this is, like, all the company history, and I've completely screwed it over. So
I gotta quit.
I was thinking that was it. There was two moments where I thought I was it. There was that, and then I thought I had lost the motion capture video that we had. And I thought I lost it in Los Angeles on a hard drive. I had to bring it to VO with me, and I couldn't find it.
Yeah.
And I thought I left in the rental car, and I kept calling them secretly. I never told Ken or Hideo or anybody, because I was like, and I worried every single morning I woke up. I thought it was going to be on YouTube. I thought all the cinematics, like the motion capture versions, were going to be on YouTube like a year before release. And I kept calling, and I spent hundreds of dollars of my own money on like international phone calls to Enterprise Rental Car, asking about this one rental car. Can you search it again? Can you search it again? I'm sure it's in there. And then I was so worried. I went back to LA, and I got to the recording studio, which is now called Formosa. And they're like, oh, you left this hard drive here. I forgot to tell you. I was like, oh, thank God. So I thought I was going to get fired over that. But the tapes, though, so this shows how like a terrible employee I was. But so these tapes, I call Victor. I'm like, I'm going to be very, very late, if at all. I might not even show up. And I start just collecting them all. And some guys started helping me. I started lining them up. There was hundreds of tapes. And I had like a spreadsheet of like each. I had them each numbered too already. So I'm like, okay, here's one. Here's three. Here's seven. Here's 15. I'm like, oh, crap, where's everything else? Lined them all up. It took me hours and hours and hours and hours. Some guy just like who worked there at the airport kept going underneath and trying to like pick more. And some of these tapes are broken. All the like ribbons coming out. I'm like, oh, my God. I can't believe it, man. Three of them were totally destroyed, and all three of those I had backups for. All the originals were fine. I was able to get them to Victor's place and capture all of them. I was so lucky. Again, never told that story to Ken or Hideo, but yeah, man, those were like two moments. And so maybe that was why I wanted to leave, because I was just so stressed out, and getting that Blu-ray out on time was so stressful, and things just weren't really working out with the video capture equipment and all that stuff. So anyway, go on vacation. We shipped. The game had amazing response. You guys hear this all the time, but you really lose perspective when you're working on a game for that long, if the game's good or not. I'm just convinced the game's going to suck. And I thought we were going to get really hammered, and we did a little bit, but not to the degree that I thought we would in terms of the game's length.
Yeah,
you know, it's a topic of relevance right now, and you know, cinematics versus gameplay and stuff like. But people didn't seem to care; they just loved the game, and I was so happy about that. I went home, loaded up. I think it was like Halo 3 and Too Human. I was playing that. I remember that around that time, and And, but before that, right when I got home, within the first week, I started, you know, spending time with my folks. My mom was getting these weird calls from this hospital, and she then told the whole family that she was diagnosed with breast cancer and that it didn't look good. And my dad looked at me and said, "You're not going back to Japan. You need to stay here and take care of your mom. And your brother's going to school, and I have to work." So I'm like, all right, this is the time. You know, I thought I was already thinking about my next move, and, I, you know, they were talking about a PSP Metal Gear, which ended up being Peace Walker.
Yeah.
I thought that would be a lot of fun, but I don't know. The timing felt right. There's just no way.
Sure, you can't.
You know, when you think that, and thankfully mom's okay now, but when you think you're going to lose your parents like that, and there was just no way.
Sure.
So I went back to Japan. I talked to Hideo. He was very supportive of the idea, and I left. And then the moment, like within 10 minutes of that news hitting the internet that I was leaving Konami, I got an email from a Microsoft recruiter, and they said, "We're looking for a director on a Halo game." So I went up there, interviewed. It was a local job, so I can be with my folks, and I got the gig.
Nice. Your story's awesome.
Yeah, that's a great. That's
hopefully it's interesting to your guys' listeners.
We should have him. We should, next time we have you back, we should have you. We should now hear about Halo. We don't have time for it now,
exactly,
but then
exactly,
your whole experience
exactly.
at Microsoft and with Xbox.
Yeah,
with Halo.
That stuff is actually a little bit harder to talk about
because it's a little newer.
It's newer, and I think they're a little more sensitive about it.
No language barrier to protect you?
No.
From what we're assuming no one's listening to
this. You want it, from what I understood, this is all, you know, through the trees you hear rumors. Your Halo 4 was going to be a match 3 where you played Cortana, right?
Yeah, and exactly, and you know, it's amazing how rumors get out, but I don't think we have
they
to do
found
the
hard drive of the mocap of the matching.
Oh
yeah,
no,
that's how they did it.
Yeah, man,
that's fascinating.
Yeah, free to play Halo. That's what I wanted, man. No,
you're visionary.
Topic number 2 for you on your Kinda Funny Gamescast debut. Mm-hmm. You're a developer. You're a big time developer. last week over on that there Kotaku. They put up a story from Anthony Birch. It was basically like an editorial he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically the five things.
Anthony Birch works at Gearbox.
Not anymore. Gearbox. Yeah, exactly. Anthony Birch went from Destructoid to Gearbox, wrote Borderlands 2 DLC, right? Or with the whole game?
I thought he wrote the whole thing, but maybe.
All right, I'm unfamiliar with his entire career, but I know for sure. And then he helped out on Borderlands, the pre-sequel, and then now he's outside of there. And this is the five things he learned being a game dev. Isn't that what basically the outside world doesn't get, what as critics and fans, nobody understands. And I wanted to know what yours were. If you what going from basically our side of the fence, being, you know, freelancer for 1UP pretty much, jumping into game development, what you learned. Because what he had done is, like, it's way harder than it looks. The games look like shit 90% of the production.
Yeah, that's true.
When developers use the word excited, they're not bullshitting you. They are excited. Like, you know, I'm really excited for this.
Yeah.
That he basically read every critique ever. Like, people, you do read the critics. Because I think when, you know, we're firing off a review, or some people's firing off a review, you're like, well, they'll never see this.
Right.
He said he read everything ever.
Oh, they read everything.
Yeah, and then basically along those lines. Yeah, so I mean, like...
That's all true.
Yeah. What are
I have
some
nothing to add. All right, moving
next
on.
Good job,
next
Anthony.
Yeah.
Next. No, what else? I mean, what were the biggest surprises, I guess, for you when you first made your jump?
Oh, man. Just how long everything takes and how everything sucks for so long. And, you know, I thought it was actually unique to Metal Gear in terms of, like, the game coming together at the last minute.
I'm
learning more and more that is actually just what most games kind of they encounter. And so a lot of work that goes before E3 or some kind of demo that they show the press, and that the game is oftentimes really terrible, like a couple weeks before that. And it's just just the nature of the beast, and it sucks because I think I've been on that side as too. I'm thinking, why don't you guys spend more time on this? And they're like, I'm playing this game, like, well, I could do this. I could point out all these problems. Like, yeah, you don't think these guys know these problems?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that was his final one, is that if something sucks, the developer knows it.
Right.
They're not like, totally, oh, we missed that fact that that boss was cheap or this happened or that you could see through that wall or whatever.
And I think that's one of what separates the good from the great in terms of game development. And a lot of these guys have different ways of achieving this, but to make your game great, you need a lot of you need something special. It could be extra time, a really supportive publisher, you know, a ton of money to throw people on the problem. You need to have some kind of policy that is like, we're not going to ship until it's ready and whatever, and screw you guys. And that's a kind of like a Blizzard approach, And
it ships when it ships.
And yeah, exactly. And there's like a lot of different, or you just kill your guys. You, like, everybody just kills themselves to get it done in time and make sure you have the extra time for polish. And for whatever reason, it's sometimes really hard for a lot of developers to get that, whether you're on a licensed title, for example, and you have to align with a movie. There's no way.
Yeah.
There's no way.
Yeah.
So that's one thing I'm really trying to find out with our studio. You know, for Republic, for example, we were set on shipping in October of 2013. We ended up shipping in December. So we shipped 2 months later, and that extra 2 months made all the difference in the world. And how did I get there? I sold I liquidated all my 401k that I had accrued from Microsoft at a huge tax penalty to pay for the staff for 2 months, right? Because I felt, and you just, that's what you need, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that episode one was everything and anything and everything, but it did make a huge difference and we got great reviews, you know?
Right.
So I'm trying to think about that for our studio moving forward too. It's like, how do we get one of those things? You know, either tons of money or tons of staff or like being able to crunch like crazy or have a publisher that lets us delay until it's perfect or, you know, all those things are really hard to get, let alone one.
Yeah.
Right.
So what, I guess, I think for, it's easier when you talk to Colin and I or, you know, people here, like we're creators, right? We've branched out on our own, done this, kind of the whole thing, right? Like, well, hopefully people support us and it goes on from there. But when you're to the point of, I'm going to liquidate all my money and I'm going to put it behind my own staff, support them for the 2 months to get this out and stuff. Like, what's going through your head? Is it just like you, there's no other way, so you have to make this work? Or is it?
That's basically it.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. There was no way I was going to ship that. I remember I was in a meeting. I remember talking to Darcy, our producer, and she's like, we have to ship. Like, you know, they believe me when I say, like, this is our burn rate. This is how much money we have left. I'm like, we have to ship. You know this, Ryan? Like, and I always had in the back of my mind, I had that 401k.
Yeah.
My dad told me not to touch it.
Oh, God, of course. That's what parents do.
Yeah. I was like, Dad, I'm 31 years old. I don't need a 401k right now. Right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I wanted that as an extra backstop. But yeah, it's just when you invest so much time in like the Kickstarter backers too, you have 11,611 guys and gals who backed your project a year or two before that. And you don't want to disappoint them. You have this responsibility as a Kickstarter or as a Patreon, right, to do good by the other guys too. Like, if your game sucks, it's another, you know, mark against crowdfunding, right?
Right.
If your game's great, it helps other people. So there's all these different pressures. Like, I know there's people at Microsoft and maybe a couple people at Konami that wanted my game to suck. Maybe they didn't like me, or, you know, they just didn't want me to be successful post those projects. And that's fine. But I wanted to prove them wrong. There's so many things that I wanted to do with that game. And so it just... I think there comes a point, like what you guys have experienced on your own, which I have like the utmost respect for, is like you have the safety net and you have to decide how bad you want this thing. And this is not for everybody, you know?
Yeah.
There's guys at Microsoft that I have tons of respect for that have, you know, five kids and full of health benefits. Dude, don't go out on your own. Are you crazy? And that's not what he wants to do anyway. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But for crazy guys like us, right? And we want to do something really big and on our own, on our own terms and stuff like that. You know, there's nothing better, right? But if you got to do it, you got to go all in, man. You got to go guns a blazing.
Yeah. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly what we figured out.
Yeah.
We tried to have it both
one
ways.
One foot in, one foot out.
It's not possible. Work, right? Nope, doesn't.
So then, how hard is it for you to put distance between yourself and critics and reviews? I mean, like when scores start coming in and stuff, like, is it what you're expecting? Is it not what you're expecting? Do you read them? Do you not read them? Do you try to stand off?
No, I read them. So, you know, knock on wood, the critics so far have been extremely positive towards our game. Right?
Yeah.
We've done 3 episodes, you know, PC's out by this time, and I hope those reviews are going to be good, but I don't go to bed at night worrying about critics. And if anything, the thing that, so at a high level, super, super happy, don't worry, not worried about critical acclaim or not for our game. That being said, I was surprised by the lack of enthusiasm on the mobile side for our game because, as you guys know, the game first came out on iOS and then Android, and now it's finally on PC and Mac. And I thought we were making like the game for these like, you know, mobile app reviewers, but a lot of these guys were tearing us apart way more than like the console-focused guys that are playing the game at like IGN or GameSpot or Game Informer or Eurogamer. They were all giving us great reviews.
Yeah.
But it was like the mobile sites were like, this is trash and what the hell is this? I'm like... To me, in my perspective, and I know I'm the most biased person in the room, but this Republic is way better than most of the crap that you guys are reviewing and giving five stars to.
Yeah.
And that was a thing that I wasn't really upset about. It was just something I really couldn't wrap my head around.
The more you think about it, is it the fact that you're a console guy, you've made console games, you're reviewing well with console players because, like Colin and I, you know, never to pick up our iPhone expecting to play video games.
Right.
I mean, this is a game designed for us, right?
Right. And that might have been my tactical error. I don't regret the move going on iOS and Android first. It actually got us way more notoriety and press coverage and attention that we would have gotten if we went to PC or console first, actually.
Yeah.
So we had a great story to tell when it comes to the release. But one of the things I've learned is that I think the game is a little bit too hardcore for the mobile audience. It's I was Ken Levine, like, you know, we were talking one day and he was like, Ryan, what you're trying to do is really, really hard. You're trying to create a market. You know, that's really hard. And yeah. I was trying to argue that I'm not trying to, that Infinity Blade is there, right? Or The Room is there, or Sword and Sorcery is there.
Device 6
is there, right? There are games, right? But he's like, yeah, but this is a different, it speaks to like the genre. That was one of my biggest tactical errors, I think, is that I brought stealth action to this mainstream mobile audience. Stealth action is one of the least user-friendly genres.
Sure. It's always fun to fail over and over again until you figure out that's what I need to do.
But people get so frustrated. I remember watching, I was in MGS4 reviews and preview events and stuff like that, and just watching really hardcore guys who say that Metal Gear is their favorite franchise getting really pissed off at the game and hating it because stealth action is kind of by design a really frustrating genre.
Sure.
You know, you guys have played that. If you sit down and play Metal Gear, you have to be in the right mindset.
Yep.
That you have to be patient. Right, and sometimes it's just not working. I don't know if you guys ever felt that, especially in MGS2.
It's all trial and error.
Yeah. Right.
When I sat down to play Ground Zeroes, it was the first Metal Gear I streamed, and frustrating because the chat's telling you how much you suck. Yeah. You're trying to show something cool, but you're not paying attention to that guy over there. I need to kill the lights, sit there, and be like, I'm gonna lay in the grass for 5 minutes,
right,
and figure out what the hell is happening.
Really, you really gotta be patient.
Mark every goddamn enemy before I make one move.
And so meanwhile, I'm like, yeah, this stealth action games, we're gonna bring it to the masses. And then I look at Telltale and all their success, where their game, and no offense to those guys because they do great stuff, but like a monkey, if you give him enough time, he can finish that game.
Yeah,
you know, not our game. Like our game is way too hard. Like on average, when we did the free app of the week with Apple, we had millions of downloads. Awesome. Wait. On average, most players were getting caught 8 times in episode 1. That's way too much, and they were quitting all the time.
Yeah,
it was just that was a tactical error. So we feel a lot more at home right now on PC and Mac because we feel like the user base is a little bit more used to this genre.
Oh, definitely. I think your game's gonna be a hit on Steam with that more hardcore gamer that finds some of the more. What is the opposite of hardcore? Casual game, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, offensive. They find those things offensive on Steam.
Yeah. So I think that's why it
seems like your game will work.
That's why I think it works so well on the fact that, like, you know, why it reviewed well with IGN, why people love it. You know what I mean? And that's the thing for me on why I haven't completed all the episodes. I started playing it, and it's just like, I really don't like gaming like this. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I've tried, and there's like certain games that'll come along. Game Dev Story. That's like my one success.
Oh, dude, it's so good.
That is like the one success. Good. I'm like, yeah, great. And then everything else is just like, I'd rather have even a mouse and keyboard. I want some kind of tactile control.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's part of our story. You know, we're about 2/3 of the way through this whole endeavor.
Yeah.
5 episodes, trying to get this game to as many platforms as possible, and the team's growing along with each episode. You know, we're becoming better crafters of entertainment and storytellers, and so it's been a really fun ride, and I wouldn't trade it for the world, even though I'm a lot poorer now.
Yeah, and make sure, I mean, today on Colin and Greg Live, we talked about, you know, Greg sent out a tweet to, you know, Shahid and Gio Corsi and,
Shuhei
Yoshida to try to get the game onto Vita, which is where I think it really belongs, and on PS4 and PS3, because there's definitely still a huge user base there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think
so. Hit those people up on Twitter and let them know you think. Yeah, because, I mean, these kinds of things really matter. What I think people have kind of lost sight of is that it's building the list, right?
Yeah, hashtag building the
building
list.
Building the list is actually worked and brought games over. Like, Sony's been instrumental, and Borderlands is the one that they always use the example of, but Tales of Hearts and other games like that were like all brought because people asked them to do it.
Yeah, they want to put stuff out there.
And so,
Where's Transistor? I want that.
Transistor would probably run on.
You think so? I mean, they're putting Bastion on. Bastion's coming over.
They'd have to strip it down a little bit.
That's the real one. That's what we've been waiting for. That's finally a win.
Yeah, that's
wrestled that one away from Microsoft.
Banner Saga,
there you
go.
Got
it. Oh, Banner Saga's come in, right?
Yeah,
Vita's awesome, man. We'd love to do it. Did you guys want to get in that inside baseball about the Vita, or you don't?
Hell yeah.
You don't care?
This is the thing: is what did you learn as a developer, and what's the inside baseball story?
Also, we could talk about Vita for 14 hours.
I'm down, man. Call me anytime. The Vita is by far, outside of PC, is by far the most requested platform. And if you look at the numbers and of sales and stuff like that, that doesn't make sense, right? But there's a very passionate, consumer base out there for quality stuff on the Vita. So for us, again, because we're built in Unity, and our game is a showpiece for this new version called Unity 5, which should be out pretty soon. We're shipping on a beta, actually, and we had to remaster the game for PC. What that means is we redid every single piece of art content in the game and made it work for Unity 5, which has really really high tech. Really, really cutting edge graphical features now. So the game looks very, very different than it does on iOS. So Unity also lets us push to lots of different platforms. We can push to Linux, Wii U, Xbox, PS4, PS3, Vita. And so a lot of people will tweet us or text us and say, like, why, like, you're on Unity, you can just push easily to Vita, and it's really not that simple.
Yeah.
You know, Sony's support is good for it, but really there's the Vita's memory is an issue. The onboard memory is a problem. So one of the things we have to do is a lot of custom work to profile the game and turn off some effects and stuff like that to make sure that the game will run. Now one of the advantages actually of building for iOS and Android first is that we actually have under the hood, we have a bunch of things that we do to profile based on each device. So the iOS, or how do I say, like the iPhone 6 version and the effects that we have and the way the game looks very different from the iPhone 4 version, because we know that the iPhone 4 has about half or less than half the memory and all these different kind of things we turn on and turn off. So there is a world that where a good looking version of the Vita game will ship. It's just there's a lot of like tweaking going
sure,
back and
you
forth.
Sure, you have to. You can't just. You it's can't not
push
as easy
a button.
As, yeah, exactly. Everybody thinks you just remap buttons, right?
Right.
Well, yeah, your left click becomes the triangle, and then it's right. over, and you put the game out.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely not that easy. Yeah, I mean what I love about this device, and we talk about it, we kid around a lot about it a lot, and we definitely are huge advocates for it. But what I love about it is that if the developers that show Vita love, and I don't mean like just put a game on Vita, but like show Vita love, they'll write
Drink
PlayStation blog. Drinkbox is a great example, exactly who I was thinking about. Like when they're like, we write PlayStation blog posts and we make these games and they work on Vita, and frankly maybe they're best on Vita and stuff like that, they get rewarded. And I was at GDC a couple years ago when Drinkbox gave a talk, and someone asked like, why would you put your game on Vita and not on iOS? And they're like, because like Vita gamers buy games and iOS gamers don't. Mm. You know, and like that's why we're we're killing on Vita, you know. And so it seems like the there's just developers out there that seem to get it, that the Vita install base is low, but that the Vita attach rate is enormous. Mm-hmm. Like fucking enormous. Right. You know? Like 2 years ago it was something like 12. You know, which
is
insane.
Ridiculous.
You know, so it's like people, you read the PlayStation blog comments or read our Twitter account or when we used to do Podcast Beyond, stuff like that, people are just crazy about that device, and if people support it, they buy the games. You know? And so I really feel like you guys have a hardcore game that speaks to that audience, and if you gave that audience love by giving them the game, I bet you they buy it.
Sure.
You know, and I think like that just it just there's just a lot of examples of it. I just think that you have to be a little more, and it seems like you are a little more attached and cognizant of that subsect of gamer that cares about this device, that if you put your game on Wii U with a comparable amount of Wii U's out there, whatever, it's going to sell probably 10 times worse. You know what I mean? Like that's just the nature of
Vita gamers know to go buy games or whatever.
Right.
It's just interesting. It's weird. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, you know, we've been studying in this industry for a long time and playing games for a long time, and I've never seen anything like this device in terms of how
indifferent. It doesn't sell huge, but the games do.
Just complete indifference from the consumer base, yet, like, people just insist on bringing their games to it.
Yeah.
Because, like, we always give a shout out to this awesome NeoGAF thread where they show all the games that are coming up, and there are more Vita games announced than any other platform. You know, and that's like, amazing. It's amazing. Man. You know, like, it's so weird.
Yeah, so we'd love to support it. You know, I love the idea of getting behind a platform that that's kind of what I was talking about on your guys's live stream is it's not just about uploading the game to these stores. It's about getting the support from either the platform holders or a publisher to help us, like the Velocity X2 guys were talking about. Like, you need that extra support to make it I want to make it an event. If we come to Vita, it needs to be an event. Right? Whether they get episode 4 early or episode 5 early, or we have exclusive content for it, or we're just optimizing the hell out of the sucker. We have cloud saves, you know, from Vita to PS3 to PS4 or whatever. Anything and everything we can do to make and that's actually one thing I learned from Metal Gear. One of the great things about Metal Gear is like, no matter what platform on them, they're always using those unique features, right? Of the platform, of the controller. And so that's what we want to do. So hopefully Sony or, you know, if Microsoft wants to do that with Xbox, whatever, we're always open to talking about those kinds of things. But
that's exciting. Well, good luck with that. I think that, there's going to be demand, I think, from the first parties for your game. So, and there probably already is. So, you know, that's exciting. You know,
and we have a controller prototype. Like moving, you can move Hope around with a left analog stick.
Why the hell didn't you ship this remastered with it? Come on, man.
6 months of work.
You're killing me with this space bar.
Minimum, man. 6 months of work.
Yeah.
Because we have to remap all of her animations to the analog stick.
You don't have a Konami 401k? Come on.
are you kidding me?
All right. The next one I want to do is a little bit a twofer. We mentioned this a second ago, this next topic, right? You talked about game length, Metal Gear Solid. This is, again, a big thing right now with The Order, 1886. I don't know if you've heard of this game.
I've heard of it.
Okay, good. It's a PlayStation.
It's beautiful.
It's very beautiful. Not incredibly long. Not as short as some were saying. If you want to speedrun it and do it, blah, blah, blah. When you're making a game as a developer, is that what you're thinking? Where's your headspace at in terms of the end experience, how long it's going to be? Are you just making a story? Are you making gameplay? What are you doing?
You know,
what the hell are you doing over there?
awesome question. I've never heard this kind of come up in the press or on podcasts and stuff like that, is how developers gauge playtime.
Yeah.
That's a really good one. And you should ask smarter people than me and who more have more experience. But from the past few games that I've shipped, you kind of have this general sense, you kind of like this really rough target, and you think, for Halo 4, for example, I think we're talking about 10 missions. I don't know how many they shipped with, maybe 8, I want to say.
That sounds about right. I vaguely remember that.
And because you factor an hour a mission, and it's about, it's a little bit over 10 hours, we should be fine. It's just really rough math, man.
Yeah.
Put on the back of a napkin.
Well, there's no way to say that what Colin, this expert gamer who's grown up a Mega Man, knows all the stuff, how long he's going to play getting every collectible versus someone who's just picking it up and playing it on the weekend every so often, not even aware, versus the guy who wants to beat it on night one and is just steamrolling, right? It's always such a weird question.
It is, and so for one of the things I've learned, and I think a lot of developers would agree, is that, and this doesn't play to the strengths of the order, but games actually take a lot longer for people to play than I think developers first expect.
Mm.
And I've always found that to be the case. Like you think, oh, this, they're going to be able to finish this in 2 hours. You put it in front of somebody, average time, 3.5 hours or 3.5 hours or something like that. So that was one thing that I've really learned. So maybe even the order guys were going like, oh man, we're shipping a 3 hour game. And
oh, six. All right. Not bad.
Like, oh yeah. The other weird thing, this gets in more of the publisher side of things, I think. But, the unfortunate thing about, Alien Isolation, for example, where it seems like they might have padded it
too long,
right? Because they're worried about, lack of value. And sometimes too much is a bad thing.
Right.
So,
That was the concern with the order, right? Leading up to when they were talking about it's longer than people are saying it is, but we jump around a lot. We want you to feel different, right? We want every gun to feel different. We want every scenario to be different. Every time you pick it up, we want you to be doing something different so there isn't repetition.
Right.
And then it was like, well, now there's no flow to the game. There's no pacing to the game. And what does that matter? When then Alien Isolation, it's just like first 8 hours are great and then there's more. Why are we still going into this?
Right. And true or false, if the order was just an amazing, incredible, unbelievable 6 hours, 7 hours, we wouldn't be having this conversation. People would be saying, oh, this is how games should be. I like a 6 or 7 hour really, really, really top-notch AAA experience. But maybe that's not what the game is, right?
No, I mean, not to me. I mean, that was the thing I've been talking about when we played The Order and, all these things started. We had The Order early, and so, a lot of these things started breaking. We couldn't talk about it. And one of the things that was frustrating us was, I don't think the game's good at all. I just think that, the length is not the problem. In fact, the length, if the game was longer, it might have been worse. And I think that was the thing that that people were ignoring was what is this, subjective notion of value, and what does that mean? And I wrote, I still write a piece a week for IGN, just op-eds or whatever. And the topic I picked up this week was, why game length, this argument of game length is weird because, Journey is not one of my favorite games of all time, but Journey was the most resonant emotional game I'd ever played. Mm. And I beat it in 90 minutes and I was crying at the end and I have no idea why. Mm. And I told Greg, I'm never playing that game again. I deleted it off my hard drive because I'm like, that 90 minutes was precious. Mm-hmm. I would pay hundreds of dollars to get 90 minutes like that again out of a game.
Yeah.
And so that is my subjective equation for value is what does the game do and what does the game mean? Unfinished Swan is another really good example of that. Like these games that are short but awesome, as opposed to, people forget when they're like, well, Final Fantasy VI took 60 hours or 70 hours to beat. And I'm like, yeah, but Final Fantasy VI is able to take advantage of the conventions of the JRPG genre, which no other genre does, which is they can just pad it however they want.
Here's another dungeon.
Yeah, well, it's not even dungeons as much as it's grinding. Like, theoretically, you should be able to blaze through a game like Final Fantasy VI in 10 hours if you want to, except for the fact that you have to level your characters up and be thoughtful and persistent in leveling your characters up, making them stronger and stuff like that. That is how they make a 10-hour game a 70-hour game. And so people are ignoring all of these tricks of the trade, as it were, that are fine. I mean, that's what an RPG is, and that's why I like them. But, so this argument about The Order was weird to me in the sense that, well, you're right. Like, if it was six really excellent hours, like Uncharted 2 and 3 especially, I think, are 10, 12 hours, and they're fucking awesome. And they don't need to be longer, and I hope that they aren't shorter, and that's good, but not every game needs to be that long. And I think people need to shake this notion of $60, 10 hours, $60, 20 hours, $60. It's like, why can't a five-hour game be $60? No, not saying that that's right or wrong. I'm just saying you could get five powerful hours for $60. So I think that people are losing sight of that,
Yeah, again, I think if it was an awesome game, I think people would be putting this thing up on a pedestal that maybe this is the future of games, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's maybe the game should have been $40. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's more of a question of the game was in development for a long time at a AAA studio, maybe that's more of a question of a publisher and not wanting to explore this middle ground that could exist for even retail products. But Jim Sterling, actually, Jim fucking Sterling's son, said he did a piece on Jimquisition where he was saying that. He's like, publishers are afraid of exploring this middle ground because they're afraid of being tagged as a budget game.
Yep, that's absolutely true.
And, yeah, and that has like a bad aura and mystique about it. It's just not, it's no bueno. They don't want that.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I bet they run the numbers too. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh yeah, what happens, you know, focus groups if we sell the order for $39.99? Less people buy it. It looks, there's a perception of lower
quality.
It's bargain
bin. Right? Yeah, yeah.
I bet there's something to that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's this particular argument just gets me in the same way that the indie and downloadable space kind of argument gets me, where it's like games that aren't $60 don't have value, and games that aren't 20 hours don't have value. And I'm like, what? Why are you? Why do you have such a narrow view?
Oh, Colin, you got to spend more time on the App Store. Then you get into this weird, really dark space where you'll never win. It's you know, you make a game that's, I have a friend who put a, you know, pretty good game out there for $1.99.
Yeah.
And people are bitching and moaning. It's 2 hours long. And like, well, I can't believe you're charging for this. It's 2 hours. Like, you want it for free. And then you start doing the whole analogy or the comparison of like, this is like less than half of a cup, price of a cup of coffee. When you get into that realm, you know you've lost, because there's no logic will prevail. It's a really, it's a dark place out there, guys.
I forget, what was Republic when it came out?
$4.99.
Yeah.
And
okay.
People complain like crazy.
Yeah.
And it was an hour and a half, 2 hour first episode. You know, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's awesome. No. It's all, I mean,
and
that's
replayable and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's weird. Like the whole, and you can, I mean, it's kind of segueing out of the specific argument of game length or how long is it, but like this whole argument also just of value outside of length about, we talked about it a little bit before about, and we have some great viewers who are saying like that they would prefer to buy your game as opposed to getting a code from you when we were giving them away on Colin and Greg Live. Because
awesome.
And it is great because there are people, and I don't want to say we're educating people because it's up to them whether or not they know. They know intrinsically that it's true, but these things cost money to make, and they're going to cost money to play. And if you cut out, if you just start, I really feel like some of it is developers' fault for under, like the iOS store, like the App Store is a fucking disaster. And like they all did it to themselves, like by undercutting each other.
Race to the bottom.
Yeah,
they did, but because they felt like they had to. And what really needed to happen was that the guys who run those stores, whether it's, you know, Google Play or App Store or whatever, I think they could have done a better job of at least holding back some of like this, like the free to play, mm-hmm. you know, phenomenon for taking over. Because I think what we end up having now is just a bunch of crap and a bunch of manipulation that goes on now.
Sure.
You have to build all this manipulation to kind of trick people or make them feel guilty or do whatever to get money out of them. It's a really bad way to interact with consumers to the limited degree you even have interaction with on the App Store, which is a whole other problem. But we still embrace it. And, I have actually really good feelings about the long-term viability of our game on the App Store because there's 1 billion iOS devices out there, a billion. And getting the game in front of even like a small like point percentage of that is a great opportunity, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like, I love to talk to different developers that have experience on the iOS store and just on iOS and Android, just in the sense of how their game succeeded or didn't, and how people, like we were talking about with Drinkbox, actually just go to Vita with 14 million of them or whatever there are out there because they're like, it's just easier, you know? I the free-to-play thing is all interesting. I mean, we talk about Plants vs. Zombies 2, which I was really excited about. It's the last time I ever played a game on my iPad, because I usually just use it to read. And they gave it to me, you know, they gave it for free. And then it's just like it constantly nickels and dimes you in the app. And I'm like, dude, it's like I would have given you $20 if you just left me alone. And now since you're bothering me, I'm not going to give you shit.
Yep.
You know, like, that's the whole
now
ironic
I'm not even going to play your game.
Yeah, like I'm just like, it's like, yeah, grind this out or pay us, you know, $2. And I'm like, I'm just going to grind it out because I resent you asking me for this when I would have just given it to you up front and you just like not talk to me, you know, or give me the option and just like the leave me alone button.
Yeah.
It's just really unfortunate. Yeah. With the way that I think consumers have been trained, and the consumers that will pay six figures into some of these iOS games, if you let them, they will.
Yeah.
And
well, that's the same thing with Patreon, right? Like, it's like you have these people who will support you and try, you know what I mean? Like that, and like Colin just wants to give this developer money, right? And then but then they get in this way and they screw it up. And the people who will, you get nickel and dime, you get addicted, maybe you go the wrong way with the money, right? And then you have things where if you have a way, like the people in the Twitch chat today who like, well, if I get a code, I still want to buy it or gift it to somebody on Steam. I want to make sure they're supporting.
That's awesome.
You.
Yeah.
That's where you hope the good wins out, right?
We actually see a positive sign. I think it's because of our kind of console pedigree and the audience that buys our game, at least on iOS, is we have a season pass, just like the Telltale games have a season pass on iOS, which is $15. It pre-purchases all the future episodes at a discount. And what we actually found was that there's more people that have purchased the season pass than who have finished episode one.
Mm.
That's strange, right? And what we talking to the Telltale guys, they basically say this is that doesn't surprise them that a lot of people, you know, want to support your game, or they're buying it in advance because they want to wait until episode 5 comes out. Mm-hmm. But that just showed a lot of goodwill, at least for us. Like, you know, and more people, way more people. This shouldn't surprise you, but the guys who buy the game at premium, if they buy it at $4.99, are more likely to buy the season pass than are the ones that get the game for free if they get it as part of a free promotion.
I guarantee that
obviously makes a lot of sense. Yeah. But it's because these people, we want to, that's our target audience, is that we want to cultivate the people that are willing to pay for quality. And a very smart person, way smarter than me, told me, he's in a consulting firm, told me, Ryan, you can't think of all consumers as the same. You have to focus on who your consumer is. You have to have your target consumer. And I was like, yeah, I'm an idiot. Like, of course, yeah, that's right. And he's like, your target consumer is not the ones that are, you know, trying to get, you know, 99-cent cheeseburgers. They want to sit down at a restaurant and eat like a, you know, a $10 cheeseburger or whatever. Yeah, yeah. And that's fine. They go after those guys.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point.
Yeah.
That's why it's going to be successful on Steam.
I should have said steak, because all developers want their games to be steak.
Exactly, steak. Filet mignon. Yeah, I think this game, I mean, the reaction was good when we showed it on Colin Greg Live. I think again, that this will be big on Steam, and I think when it comes to console, it'll be big there, too.
It speaks to the console, the hardcore gamer.
You started,
I hate doing that, but
it's funny, because you started at a place you thought you should be and probably needed to be in the iOS market, but the place that was most unintuitive for a development studio like you to be. Right. But I think what's so cool about that is now, I don't want to say the hard work's over, because the hard work's never over for a studio like yours, and you guys are still working on the game and stuff, but maybe that the trials and tribulations are over. Like, if you go to Xbox One, for instance, there's got to be some confidence that you're like, well,
you know, these people will get it.
Yeah.
These people will get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And shipping this huge game with all the memory constraints and all the things we're learning about iOS and pushing iOS in areas that they've never been pushed before, outside of maybe Infinity Blade and a couple other things. So you're right. Yeah. We took the hard path, and that's kind of like what I want to do with my life anyway. Mm-hmm. So hopefully it'll pay off.
You want to be challenged.
I want to be challenged. I want the Dark Souls path of life. I'm not, you know, playing some, you know, game that's like constantly throwing achievements at me. I want to earn those babies.
Mm-hmm. Damn right. I like that. Yeah. Get a new 401k. Republic Remastered. Out right now. If you're hearing this, go get it.
PC and Mac. Humble Store. GOG. That's not Greg.
No, it's not Game Over Greg.
Game Over Greg. Greg. Steam. So thank you so much for
PlayStation
supporting
soon.
It. No problem. Our pleasure.
Final topic of the Kind of Funny Games cast for this week. It should be a fast one, first off, because you have to go. But also because we've hinted around. You've played this The Last of Us, right?
Yeah, of course. It's my favorite game of 2013.
Well, all right. You have good taste. Over on Patreon.com, Adam Kershaw backed us at a certain amount to get his question right
on
the
air.
Thank you very much, Adam. And his question is, one of my favorite shows you guys ever did was Last of Us Spoiler Cast. There surely has to be a sequel. Where do you see the story going, and what do you want to see from the next game? Love you guys. Go Islanders. Adam Kershaw.
Good man.
So clearly this is a spoilers one. If you haven't beaten The Last of Us yet, you probably want to bounce. Exactly. Yeah, but I'm never gonna untap my head on this one, because it's just to the end now.
I don't know.
The windows, to the walls.
It was clear to me that, you know, I did the history of Naughty Dog. I spent a lot of time at that studio and wrote like 50,000 words on the studio or whatever. And I never got to write the piece about The Last of Us because
everything changed
and I never had. It was all primary sources, so I just never got to write it. But it was clear to me that they didn't necessarily design the game to be
a sequel,
nor did they necessarily want to do one. But I think that they were always open to the idea of doing it. I think now that the game sold, 6 or 7 or 8 million copies, whatever it sold, it's a no-brainer. And so I've said time and time again, like, just to get right into it, that my personal opinion on the sequel to The Last of Us is that I'd like it to start literally right at the ending of The Last of Us.
She sighs and you pick right out from the
talk to each other and just start right there.
Yeah, I'd play that.
Well, here's the thing, is that I'd play any of them. Doesn't happen. Like, I really hope they don't.
Oh,
like,
you're one of those guys. No,
I am
sequel?
One of those.
Oh, they're
going to
make a sequel.
I know. I'm not betting that it's not going to happen. I know it's going to happen, but I wish they wouldn't. And if they did do it, I would have rather seen something that we've always talked about, like more DLC of Ish's Tale or something, right? Like, I'd rather see even filled in when Joel, a younger Joel story, a prequel to that, you know what I mean? To see everything happen.
I think it's likely to, you might see some of that stuff, right?
Yeah.
These guys are gutsy, you know?
If anything, I'd like to see, and if we have to go forward more, and they are very gutsy, if we have to go forward more, I would want to see, I think I'd want time to pass, see Ellie a bit older, Joel a bit older, and go from there and see. I still want, I always, when I beat The Last of Us, right, I immediately started texting Neil Druckmann because he was like, what did you think? I'm like, I'm not there. And I texted him immediately. I'm just like, I was the bad guy. I was playing the bad guy. He's like, you're not the – that's up to interpretation. I'm like, no, fuck that. Joel is a bad guy. But his choice –
by the end, right.
And that's the thing is that you get to get in these conversations with people, especially people who have daughters. And like, no, he made the right choice. I would never have done that. And
yeah,
I'm like,
this is good. That's
but like,
good.
You know, what I was hoping when it's happening – I mean, not even when it's happening because I'm just too floored by what is happening. But I always wanted her to wake up and be like, they told me I was going to die. Like, if it picks right up, I want her to be like, you know, they told me this was going to kill me, and this was my choice, and you've stolen it from me. You know what I mean? Like, I want there to be conflict between Joel and Ellie, which sucks because I love them and I love their relationship.
You're probably going
to
get it.
That's what I want. Like, that's what I want to see in the next one for sure, is there to be some kind of repercussion with her based on what he did.
Yeah, the way they ended it, there's no way that they wouldn't be able to, that they wouldn't go across those waters, right?
Yeah.
Those
yeah, because she waters. Sighs like she knows.
She knows.
She knows he was lying to her. Fucking God good, damn it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to me, you know, it's funny the way that people interpret that game too, because I remember talking about it on the SpoilerCast before. We had Neil and Bruce on Podcast Beyond, like, after the game came out, and we were talking about it. I remember in the SpoilerCast, my whole thing was, Greg was like, you play as a bad guy. I'm like, no, you're not. There's no guarantee that that cure was going to work anyway, and in fact, the Fireflies might have been lying to you.
No way.
And Greg was like, you're crazy, and everyone was like laughing at me, and I remember talking when Bruce came, or Neil was like, no, it's a great point. Like, they never actually, there's no guarantee the cure was going to work, and there's no guarantee the Fireflies were telling anyone the truth. Yeah, so like, it was,
they can do whatever they want.
Yeah, so it was like, to me, I was like, Joel made it was definitely a selfish choice.
Yeah.
But my whole rationale when he did it was, in my mind, if I was in Joel's position, I'd been like, where's the guarantee this is going to work? You have no show me, no proof that you know this is the sacrifice of this girl is going to work. And I think that's what everyone got caught up on, as opposed to the way I looked at it, I think a lot of other people looked at it, and I think the way Neil might have even written it, which was, that there is no guarantees, and so he isn't the bad guy. It's like way more nebulous than that. That said, you know, they downplay it or don't talk a lot about it, and I do believe them in terms of the rationale, or the inspiration for the game being The Road, which I think is, you know, Cormac McCarthy's book, which I think is, it's fucking obvious, but like, they don't take a lot of inspiration from it. But when I think about that book, one of the great books I've ever read, it's about a father and his son, but really the star of the entire book is the world. And I think we also have to get caught up with that Joel and Ellie are special and we love them, but I think maybe the star of The Last of Us is actually that world. And like, I wonder if like the story that you tell has nothing to do with them at all. And it's like a totally, The Last of Us 2 is just a different,
that, man. Yeah.
Just a different story about a different group. Maybe the Fireflies do have a national reach, I guess, at least from Boston to Salt Lake, but maybe it's about a different group or in a different country, or
maybe it's the Fireflies going after Joel. You know what I mean? They've put it together that this was happening, that there was this massacre. He's kind of like a legend, right? He is I Am Legend. Mm-hmm. Now they have to go after him. That's what your mission is.
So, yeah, I think that, like, the whole Ish thing, like, is obvious, and I think that should have been the DLC, and I don't think they're going to go back to that or whatever. And I think the DLC they did Left Behind was amazing. I wish I had no combat at all. I wish that they had the balls to do something like that. But, you know, I think that the Last of Us sequel is definitely going to happen. I'm sure it's in pre-production now. I'm sure that the entire, even though they have their two-team kind of thing going on at Naughty Dog, that all of them are on Uncharted.
Most
are on
Uncharted. They're going to have to roll off, right? Right.
Yeah, so I don't think anything's happening now, and I don't think The Last of Us 2 is imminent at all. I think you see it 2018, 2019 maybe. But I hope that if they don't continue right after the ending, I hope that it's just totally different. Like a totally different story. But I can understand the sanctity of that story in terms of like leaving it alone, but Sony's pretty blatant about it, and everyone is, Activision and Ubisoft, everyone that makes IP, that, you know, they make IP to make
sequels. You
want to
make money, you're a business.
Yep. And if that IP came out the gate and sold 8 million units, then
well,
I can't
hopefully
imagine.
It's as good as Peace Walker.
Yeah, and give me The Last of Us Portable. Bite-sized operations.
You know, we got to talk about Peace Walker at some point, but I got to run.
I know,
you guys can keep going.
No, we're ending.
We'll wrap it.
Yeah, yeah.
What's I'm on? Sorry.
No, it's nothing besides.
No, I've been watching it. Don't worry. We're going to get you out of here at 3 and get you an Uber. Don't worry about it, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a pleasure having you on the Kind of Funny Games cast. Remember, each and every Friday we post this at patreon.com/kindoffunny. Then the next week it's broken out topic by topic over on youtube.com/kindoffunnygames. Damn, patreon.com/kindoffunnygames is the Patreon. You can just go to Patreon, find Kind of Funny. We're everywhere. Go to kindoffunny.com, find everything. Then MP3 YouTube on Friday. It's great. It's been a pleasure having
you,
Ryan Payton.
Thank you, sir.
Republic Remastered is out right now on Steam. GOG. Humble.
Don't say it.
I'm not going to say it. One day to Mac. One day to Mac.
Yeah,
one day probably
it,
to Vita, because we know people.
You got it.
Everybody go get it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Colin, thank you for yours.
Oh, my pleasure.
Until next time, I'm not Tim Geddes.